This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Mother of Black Hollywood, a memoir by Jennifer Lewis with Malaika Adaro. This is Jennifer Lewis. Dedication. To Julia Walker, who saved my life and then saved her own. You're playing small does not serve the world. Who are you not to be great? Nelson Mandela. Dorothy May Lewis was not a woman to mess with. One day, when I was about 6, I held Mama's hand as we walked home from Miss Wood's store where Mama had bought a bottle of Coca-Cola. Well, out of nowhere, her boyfriend at the time, Jelly Bean, pulled up in his station wagon and called out for my mother. Hey, Dorothy, come here. Now, my mother was pretty much the queen of Kinloch, Missouri. And the one thing you did not do was summon her to do anything, anywhere, at any time. My mother ignored Jelly Bean. He said, Dorothy, you hear me talking to you? She said, go on somewhere else, Jelly. Can't you see I'm with my baby? Jelly Bean then made the biggest mistake of his life. He pulled the car over to where Mama and I stood, reached out of the window, grabbed Mama's right arm, and said, "You gonna talk to me right now, Dorothy." I was still holding her left hand tightly, aware of the time bomb that was about to explode. What I can tell you now is that it was all over in 5 seconds. It ended with Jelly Bean speeding away and a trail of blood that led to the corner where the station wagon had taken a sharp right and disappeared. And as small as Kinloch was, we never saw Jelly Bean again. Ha! And y'all wanna wonder where I get it from. 1. Blackish to Greenish. After 2 weeks of intensely working out, I had not lost 1 fucking pound. Yet, ready or not, there I was, my first day on the set of Blackish. The show is what every actor dreams of, a primetime hit on national network. My first scene was with Morpheus from The Matrix. Of course, I mean Lawrence Fishburne, the brilliant actor who plays my ex-husband, Pops. I was about to deliver my initial line. Now, one would think that this moment would be fun, easy, even fabulous. I mean, after all, I've been doing television for what seemed like 100 years, from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air to Murphy Brown, from In Living Color to Friends, and on and on. But 10 years had passed since I worked consistently on the small screen. Once again, the gods of television had summoned me back. Back to bring the Jennifer Lewis magic. Back to deliver the take-no-prisoners attitude and deep, rich tone that made mine one of the most recognizable voices in Hollywood. But I'll be damned if now, at the moment of truth, I could remember 1 line of the script I had studied. After 259 episodic television shows, 63 movies, and 4 Broadway shows, the great Jennifer Lewis could not remember 1 fucking line. I was a nervous wreck. No one on the Blackish set besides me knew it, though. I asked for a moment and grabbed my script. As I sat down and put on my glasses, I knew I would be forgiven for the pause. After all, I was new to the set, and the rest of the cast had already shot several episodes together. Come on, Jenny. Come on, baby. You can do this. I was not about to disappoint all these people, the cast and crew, the writers, the producers, and ABC Disney, who had hired me without a single audition. To better focus, I took 3 deep breaths and finally got the lines in my head, then whispered, "Come on, Jenny. Come on, baby. Get up. Get your ass up and deliver." In the days before, like a fool, I had read the Facebook comments about the announcement that I would be on Black-ish. "Oh, shit, here comes Jennifer Lewis. Hey, she my play auntie, y'all. That's right. They got the mother of Black Hollywood. Oh, my God, she's fabulous. She's this, she's that." Now I felt like I had to live up to all that love. I couldn't let it shake me. I had to shut down all the internal noise and get in the moment of my character, Ruby Johnson. "Come on, pull yourself together, Miss Bachelor's degree in theater arts." I'd studied Stanislavski, Feldenkrais, and with the great Uta Hagen, no less. Where did Ruby come from, and what is her objective in this scene? I had been working on Ruby. I wanted her to be a whole person, warm, grounded, smart, quirky, and very, very funny. A woman who loves her son, perhaps a bit too much, never cuts her daughter-in-law any slack, and who loves her grandbabies above all else. And, of course, Ruby had to be fabulous. So again, like another fool, I'd said yes to the 4-inch pumps, completely forgetting what they would do to my ever-present, aching plantar fasciitis. I stood there feeling fat. My right knee was throbbing. I felt old. What was I doing here anyway? My thoughts flashed back to a few months earlier, when I had seriously considered retiring. I decided to treat myself to a much-needed vacation and jetted off to Europe to have some fun and ponder my life, not only my career, but also the fact that at age 57 I was still single. Despite being engaged 4 times, I had never made it to the altar. Of course, yes, I kept the rings. I was off to Athens, where I boarded the Seven Seas, an exclusive luxury cruise ship. For 3 weeks, it was just me, myself, and I, a little barefoot colored girl from poverty-stricken Kinloch, Missouri. I had worn one of my huge straw hats, expensive dark shades, trying to be incognito, and a moo-moo. I extended my passport and ticket to the young steward. He then stretched his neck and peered under my hat. Even though he was Italian, he proceeded to do an Irish jig, and with no care for his job security, screeched in front of all the first-class passengers, "Jackie's back!" He was referring to the title of the 1999 Lifetime movie in which I had starred. News spread to the ship that a celebrity was on board. There was a knock at the door. It was my butler. Yes, that barefoot little colored girl had a butler, informing me I was invited to dine at the captain's table. Though I hadn't planned on it, I admit I enjoyed the celebrity treatment. I basked in my luxury suite and lounged on my private balcony as we made our way around the Aegean, the Mediterranean, and the Adriatic. But my joy was tempered by the decision before me, to retire or not to retire. I still bristled from the recent disappointment of not being chosen for several roles I had wanted. I didn't get Orange is the New Black, but my dear friend Lorraine Toussaint did. I didn't get Getting On, but my dear friend Niecy Nash did. I hated the fact that after 40 years in the business, I still even had to audition. And damn, could it possibly be true that as a singer, I had never even recorded an album? On top of all that, I had just broken off another engagement. Okay, now I'm doing what my therapist Rachel would call garbage collecting. Stop bitching, Jenny. We soon arrived at Katakalon, Greece, the site of the original Olympics nearly 3,000 years ago. I went to the fields where the games had been played. What impressed me most was the excavation of still-intact hovels and looming columns. There was a walk of shame where they carved the names of the athletes who had cheated. I was grateful my name wasn't there, because although I've always been athletic, I was one cheating ass when I was a kid. A few days later, in Montenegro, we visited several magnificent wineries. Winding through the twisting roads, we had to take a sudden detour. There had been an accident up ahead, and someone had been killed. A grim reminder of how so very fragile we are, and how precious life is. As the Seven Seas approached the Croatian city of Dubrovnik, the view of the orange-roofed old town took my breath away. I visited the Church of St. Francis, where some local women were singing folk songs in the courtyard. I admired their beautiful harmonies, and when they beckoned me forward, I joined them. Actually, I just barged in and sang baritone. They good-naturedly allowed me to arrange them like the Supremes, drawing on the poses I had been taught by Michael Bennett himself during rehearsals for the workshop production of Dreamgirls. On a small boat from Dubrovnik back to the Seven Seas, there was an older Caucasian American man who took it upon himself to extra notice me, a middle-aged black woman traveling alone on a VIP ship. He knew that if in fact I was alone, I had paid $9,000 more than he had, the nasty little single occupancy fee. For some ungodly reason, this man yelled over the boat's motor, "So where'd you get your money?" I turned slowly. Would he ask a white man this question? Was this mofo implying a black woman shouldn't have money? I was this close to pushing him overboard. No doubt the old Jennifer Lewis would have cussed him out in a rage-fueled tirade. But as a person with bipolar disorder who spent 17 years in therapy, I had finally learned to control my rage and was grateful for the behavioral skills and medication that gave me that control. I took 3 deep breaths and decided not to slap the shit out of him. Instead, I said, "Oh, you didn't know? I own the Seven Seas." His much too young wife, naively believing my statement, chimed in with a high pitch, "Oh, really?" I returned the "Oh, really?" in a deep, low pitch Betty Davis used responding to Joan Crawford in the movie Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. "Oh, really?" The mic had been dropped on the shores of Dubrovnik. Another war had been won, and not a single life had been taken. The next stop in Croatia was the island of Far, where I swam at a rocky beach. I was very thankful that my friend Deborah Dean Davis had told me to bring special shoes for the stony beaches. A nice couple from Germany watched my belongings as I swam. Afterward, they invited me to have a drink. The friendliness of the people of Far put me in a peaceful mindset. I felt ready to spend my final night at sea, contemplating whether or not to retire. Later on my balcony under a big fat moon, I had a frank conversation with myself. "What are you gonna do, kid?" Could I really face another, "Thank you, Miss Lewis, next?" Or, "We're looking for a Jennifer Lewis type, not the real thing." Fuck show business. Did I really want to continue watching myself age on a 5-story tall movie screen? I was blessed to have already realized so many wonderful dreams. An electrifying standing ovation at Carnegie Hall when I sang with the New York Pops Orchestra. Performing for royalty in Monaco. Headlining in Hello Dolly at the esteemed Fifth Avenue Theater in Seattle. And of course working with some great actors. Everyone from Denzel Washington and Meryl Streep to Tom Hanks and Taraji P. Henson and Matt Damon. I had so many amazing memories to retire with. But wait. Be honest, Jenny. Is there anything else? Anything? Shit. There is one more dream. I have wanted it all my life. A one-woman show on Broadway. Like the great ones who had paved the way. The likes of Lily Tomlin, Whoopi Goldberg, Elaine Stritch, and Anna Deavere Smith, to name a few. And maybe one or two other as yet unrealized dreams. Like I still hadn't played Mama Rose and Gypsy. My friend Mark Shaman joked that the black version of Gypsy would be titled Nipsey. Asshole. I guess I could live without playing Mama Rose. But without that one-woman show, I know in fact when I reach those pearly gates, St. Peter's first words to me would be, "What happened to that one-woman show? Get your unheavenly ass back down there and get that Tony." How do I make it happen? A one-woman show on Broadway starring Jennifer Lewis. Jennifer who? Dear God, what an undertaking. People recognize me, but frankly, plenty of them don't even know my name. Why would Broadway backers be willing to invest millions of dollars in me? Well, I'll just have to become more famous. And there's one sure way of doing that, besides a sex tape. Primetime Network TV. I leaned on the rail and gazed at the perfection of the moon, the stars, and the Adriatic Sea. I howled up at that big fat moon, true to the alpha wolf who runs through my veins. I'm Jennifer motherfucking Lewis. I am the show and show business. Who was I trying to kid? To retire from show business would be to retire from the act of breathing. I closed my eyes and said a silent prayer. Yes, a primetime show. A show that's top quality. In a role that recognizes my talent and experience, where I can really show my chops and make people laugh, think, and cry. I wanted to work with great actors and writers I admired and could grow with. Now listen, God. I don't want to be the lead in the show. I don't want to work that hard anymore. Oh, and this is the most important thing. Please let the show shoot close to home. Don't even let me get started about the L.A. traffic. I blew a soft kiss to the moon, smiled, and took my ass to bed. 2 days later, I touched down at LAX and was picked up by my dear friend and manager, Julia Walker. She allowed me to go on and on about my vacation. Girl, I had a fabulous time. I hiked up the ancient walls of Dubrovnik. In Montenegro, there was an unimaginable rainbow over the limestone cliffs in the Bay of Qatar. I'll show you a picture later. And listen, Jew, there are these two islands just off Venice, right? The first one, Murano, is where they do this fabulous glass-blowing demonstration. On the second one, Burano, they make this wonderful lace. Oh, and honey, I met this French boy in Athens up at the Acropolis. He was staring at my cleavage, but he was all hot and sweaty, and you know I didn't have time for a Parisian. It would have made for a good story, but it was just not going to happen, okay? He was real cute, though. In Corfu, your girl almost went hungry because my credit card wouldn't swipe through at a food stand. So I deliberately showed that guy my cleavage, and he let me have a turkey and goat cheese sandwich for free. Oh, and Julia, the food on the ship was incredible. I was so undisciplined. I ate like anybody and everybody's pig. The chef was a Fresh Prince fan, and would make me anything I wanted. And the desserts were stupid. I must have put on at least 10 pounds. Thank God I've got 2 months to get in shape before the Human Rights Campaign honors me in St. Louis. As we rode down Sepulveda to get on the heinous 405 freeway, I saw a huge billboard for the new ABC show Blackish and asked, "Oh, how's that show doing?" Julia didn't respond. When I turned to look at her, she had a silly, sweet smile on her face. "I was giving you a moment before I told you. They called. They want you to play Anthony Anderson's mother. They want you for Blackish." I said, "Well, Blackish better have some greenish." Yeah, that quip was a good one. But underneath, I was thinking, damn, I didn't expect my Adriatic prayer to happen this fast. It had only been 2 nights ago when I was speaking to God. I guess I'll be kissing the moon more often. Julia continued, "And you're booked to start in 2 weeks." I fell into a dead panic. "Bitch, are you insane? Did I mention I ate fried cheese every fucking day? And chocolate? And butter-drenched escargot? And creme brulee for breakfast? That camera's gonna put another 10 pounds on my ass. And oh my God, it's all high definition these days, so everyone watching can see every pore and wrinkle." It had been 8 years since I played Lana Hawkins on Strong Medicine, the hit Lifetime television drama. My memory had gotten worse. And I was gonna have to learn lines, 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 not to mention my knees now had names. Arthur and Ritus Jackson. Shit, I needed at least 6 months to get ready. Look, was I excited to get back to work? Yes. Was I appreciative? Yes. But I was really scared at the same time. Come on, Jenny. Come on, time to slay. When I arrived home, I kissed and played with my Bichon Frise butters, named for the character on South Park, and collapsed from jet lag. Lying on my bed, my mind was racing. "You got 2 weeks, Missy." I got out of bed, flew downstairs to my gym, and mounted my elliptical. I did 45 minutes of cardio. Then it was on to weights and 60 squats. Come on, Jenny. The next morning, I rode my bike 7 miles, thinking about the time I'd join Weight Watchers. I went once, sang all them Big Mamas a blues song. After all, they were a captive audience, and never went back. I had to get serious. I needed a regimen. I made an arrangement for my niece Michiko to start training me every day. I wanted to look like I had 20 years earlier on The Fresh Prince, when I was beautiful from every camera angle. But like I said, I had not lost 1 fucking pound by the time, 2 weeks later, when I drove my big black S5 Mercedes through the gates of one of the most beautiful and historic movie lots in the world, the Walt Disney Studios. The security guard at the gate shouted, "Hey, Flo! Hey, Mama Odie!" Disney is a home away from home for me. I am more famous here than at any other studio. And most Disney employees, from security guards to the chefs in the commissary, are huge fans of Disney animations. They know every movie, actor, and voice. I smiled at the security guard as I fantasized that I was the great Gloria Swanson playing Norma Desmond in the movie Sunset Boulevard when she returns to Paramount, the studio she had made famous. In my fantasy, I wanted the guard not to recognize me so that, like Norma Desmond, I could say to him, "Open the gate and watch your manners, because without me, there would be no Disney studio." I pulled into the parking space marked Jennifer Lewis in front of Stage 4, thinking, "Wow, you've come a long way, baby." Still in my Norma Desmond fantasy, I thought, "Oh my God, will anyone remember me?" The answer, thank goodness, was yes, yes, and yes. They came and they came and they came. I was encircled by the cast and crew welcoming me, smiling and gushing. After all my years in show business, I had worked with damn near every one of them in some capacity or another. Wardrobe, makeup, set designers, the driver, the assistant directors. Even the dialogue coach was my dear friend Iona Morris, a talented actress and director. I knew and loved them all. And on they came, embracing, reminiscing. Hey, Jennifer, remember when Tupac had all them girls in his trailer on the set of Poetic Justice? Remember me? I was the stunt coordinator when you clocked Jim Carrey with that rubber skillet on in Living Color. We're so excited you're here. We've been waiting. It wasn't only about show business. One crew member said, Hey, Jennifer, my brother loves you. When he saw you on Oprah talking about having bipolar, he went and took care of himself. Even the executives from the front offices came down to the Black-ish set to welcome me. I was lit up. I had, of course, worked with the oh-so-very talented Tracy Ellis Ross on Girlfriends and Five, a wonderful Lifetime movie that Alicia Keys had directed. I knew Anthony Anderson's brilliant and funny work on everything from Law and Order to Hustle and Flow to Barbershop. And, of course, there was Lawrence Fishburne, who had not only played Ike Turner, the son-in-law to my Tina Turner's mama in What's Love Got to Do with It, but whose body of work was beyond impressive, including some of the most important films of our time, from Apocalypse Now to Boys in the Hood and all of the Matrix films. I was thrilled to reconnect with Kenya Barris, the creator of Black-ish, who was just a young writer when we'd first met on Girlfriends. I dub him genius. Following the warm welcome, it was time for the usual television routine, 2 hours in the makeup and hair trailer. And of course, all the last-minute rushing. There's always so much hurry up and wait. I sat in my dressing room, mic'd for sound, zipped into Ruby's clothes, only to wait. All this waiting gave me too much time to fret. Would I fit in? The rest of the cast was already a family. I was only a guest star at that point. I would have to gauge and get in sync with their rhythm. Could I do it? Finally, a knock at the door. They're ready for you now, Miss Lewis. I entered the sound stage trying to look cool. After a few preliminaries, including my last-minute pause to look at my script, shooting began. Now, confident in my lines, I step onto my blue tape mark opposite Lawrence. The set was put on a bell, signaling all cast and crew to fall silent. The first AD shouted, Rolling! I inhaled, shoulders back and spine straight. I felt the entire company lean in, smiling expectantly, as all eyes fell on me. The mother of Black Hollywood, the veteran of nearly 300 productions, the woman they hired without auditioning. The director shouted, Action! I exhaled, thinking of that kiss I'd blown to the full moon over the Adriatic. I go inside. I become Ruby Johnson. I deliver my first line. Within seconds, I hear the sound I've been listening for all my life. The rising, swelling lion's roar as dozens of people collapse in laughter and applause. And the bitch is back. 2. Shoulders back, titties first. I am a born entertainer. Even as a little girl, I dreamed of being a star. I would be an entertainer had I been born 100 years earlier or later. Had I been born a unicorn or even been born on Neptune. I would be somewhere singing in somebody's universe, filled with music and fire. I started early. I was 5 years old when I went to Miss Vera and asked to sing a solo in the annual church program called The Old Ship of Zion. About 10 choir members started in the back of the church singing a song as they moved one by one down the center aisle. After they reached the choir stand, they boarded the ship in recognition of the vessel in the Bible that carried believers to the Promised Land. When the last soloist had reached the stand, the entire choir sang, "'Tis the old ship of Zion." I asked Miss Vera if I could sing a song called, "O Lord, You've Brought Me a Mighty Long Way." Miss Vera said, "Jenny, you're only 5 years old, honey." But I said, "But that's the one I listen to on my pink clothes and play record player." The day of the program, there I stood in the back of the church, in my black patent leather shoes and folded over lace socks. I had on a blue skirt and a white blouse, the standard choir uniform. I knew this was my moment, and I totally was prepared to show out. My mama, aunts and uncles and cousins, as well as the deacons and mothers of the church, the entire congregation all had their eyes on me. Miss Vera played a glissando on the organ to give me my note. I leaned back and did an exaggerated back bend in effort to fill my little lungs. Gradually returning to an upright position, I slowly released my first note. Oh, 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 oh. I held it for what seemed an entire minute. Oh, oh, Lord, You brought me a mighty long way. I grabbed the side of the back pew, steadying myself in dramatic fashion. They said I couldn't make it, but You brought me, Jesus, You brought me a mighty long, long way. I knew I had him in the palm of my hand when I heard my aunts Catherine, Louise, Rosetta, Jean, Shirley, Gloria, Janice, Margaret, and Mary, and even my own mama shouting, "Sing, Jenny! Go ahead on, baby! Sing, baby!" I two-stepped down the aisle past five more pews to the spot where an usher, Sister Lorraine Parks, stood erect waiting to catch anyone who got the Holy Spirit and fell out. Love me some black church, y'all. I grabbed Miss Parks' fan from her hand, leaned against her, and fanned myself furiously, singing, "Somebody help me." Then going limp, I bent over, sucked in a huge breath so I could growl the next phrase as I'd heard pastors do in their sermon. Yes, sir. Oh, yeah, Lord Almighty, a mighty long way. One of the deacons jumped up and guided me aboard the ship. When I turned around at the standing microphone, I really cut loose. I leaned the mic over like James Brown, and I waved it around like Sarah Vaughan. Then I did a little praise dance like I'd seen Sister Moten do every morning to show off her new clothes. When I saw Sister Ethel Miller snatch a big, big hat off her head and throw it in the air. Well, that was it. I riffed one more time. Thank you, Lord Jesus. My solo flowed from my five-year-old self with a force and feeling so great the entire congregation of First Baptist Church of Kinloch, Missouri, exploded in a standing ovation. I knocked them out doing my best imitation of the great gospel artist Dorothy Love Coates singing with the gospel harmonettes. In that moment, my destiny as a singer was sealed. Though we were there to praise God, I loved that I was getting some of that praise too. I plugged my mouth with my thumb and stood there a bit cross-eyed. I felt steeped in love and secure in the knowledge that I was indeed a child of God. My family didn't have much money for extras, but music was a constant presence in our home. We were all good singers, and between Mama and my older siblings, I spent hours listening to the greatest of the greats in gospel, jazz, popular music, Mahalia, Ella, Aretha, B.B. King, Ramsey Lewis. And for comic relief, there was lots of Mom's Mabley. I felt a profound soul connection with them all. As I grew up, my burning desire to be a star flourished. I told any and everybody who would listen that I was gonna be famous. And baby, I was real serious about it. I'd grab my hairbrush, stand in front of a mirror, and Aretha Franklin your ass all day. I studied and imitated the old classic Hollywood movies, especially musicals that came on the Late Late Show. I watched with fierce intensity, reveling in the magic of multi-talented superstars such as Judy Garland, Ethel Merman, and Sammy Davis Jr. I identified with these 20th century greats, with Betty Davis, with Tallulah Bankhead, their flair, their power. As a kid, I sought to emulate Hattie McDaniel's timing in Gone with the Wind and Danny Kaye's mastery of tongue twisters. When I got a little older, the whole town anticipated my monthly talent shows. I bothered Father Siebert over and over to let me use the Catholic Church school basement. I worried that poor man, who was Kinloch's sole white resident, so much, one day he just said, "Anything you want, Jenny." I cut up brown paper bags to make signs, and in black magic marker I wrote, "Jennifer Lewis sings, 7 p.m. Saturday, 35 cents. I taped the signs to the telephone poles all over town, and baby, you couldn't get in for the crowd. People would come all dressed up. The talent shows became so popular, folks would barbecue outside in the parking lot and sell rip-tip sandwiches, pig feet, and hot dogs with orange and cream sodas. It was the Saturday night event in Kinloch. I would sing songs by Aretha, Fontella Bass, and Gladys Knight with my cousins as my pips. Years later, my cousin Ronnie reminded me that I never paid my pips. I would just run out with all the cash at the end of the show. Let's just say I didn't deny it. These talent shows, starring me, of course, allowed me to practice for the time I, like Dionne Warwick or Nancy Wilson, would make my grand entrance on the Ed Sullivan Show. I could see myself in a class with these greatest of the greats because I felt my gift, my talent, my ability to entertain was so innate, so powerful, so evident that God had given me something special. Judge me if you must, but it was my reality. Call it delusional, call it grandiosity, call it what you will, but it was my dream, and it kept me going through some dark times. I used what I learned from these legends in many of my most popular roles. When I played Will Smith's Aunt Helen on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, I mixed in shades of Pearl Bailey. In the Cars animation, my character Flo is a mix of Edward G. Robinson's nasality, Mae West's sass, and Lauren Bacall's sultriness. In my scene with Denzel Washington in The Preacher's Wife, when we're talking outside in the cold, my character is pure Betty Davis. In the sitcom Girlfriends, Tony's drunk mother is Lucille Ball. And the sorceress, Mama Odie in Princess and the Frog, is straight up Mom's Mabley. The point is that I am aware that I stand on the shoulders of many great entertainers. I still study the greats. It's what keeps my game on point. I do not consider it boastful to say I am a great entertainer. Look, it's just a fact. I can sing you a song and tell you a story. I can make you dance and shout. I can hold you in the palm of my hand and make you feel alive. I can get you weak in the knees, catch you, say I'm sorry, then rock you to sleep. But above all things, I can make you laugh. And I mean laugh your ass all the way off. Apparently the only thing I can't do is stop talking about myself. On May 25th, 1979, I headed to New York City, having graduated the day before with a degree in theater arts from Webster University, just outside of St. Louis. Finally, I was leaving St. Louis for good and pursuing my destiny. Finally, I was taking my shot at fame and stardom. My whole family, 6 siblings and my mother, came to the airport to send me off. St. Louis to New York, TWA nonstop. I used my graduation money to fly first class. It just felt appropriate. On other trips to New York for auditions, I had envied the grandness of first class. Now it was my turn to recline, sip champagne, and smoke my Virginia Slims. Lambert International Airport was a hub for Transworld Airline, and Kinlock was right under the flight path. Looking through my first class window, I felt a twinge of irony as the plane roared over Kinlock, and I gazed down on the narrow streets and small houses of my childhood. And then I turned my attention toward the future and the fulfillment of my lifelong dreams. In my mind, I was unstoppable. A freshly minted degree certified me as a classically trained actress. I believed I could sing like nobody else, and felt that although I wasn't the best dancer, my presence on stage was riveting. I roared into New York confident, thirsty. What's next, bitches? If it's got anything to do with performing or being funny or fabulous, I'm your girl. If it's got anything to do with Shakespeare, Ibsen, Moliere, or Chekhov, I'm your girl. Oh, and by the way, watch me kick my foot above my head, then slam it to the floor in a full split. And if you're not feeling me, just tell me what note, what key, and how fast or slow you want it. How many hula hoops around my neck? I hit New York prepared to conquer, to win, to slay. And why not? All my life I had been held for my abilities, made to feel special, singled out. As a kid, I was a born leader, the alpha of the pack. In high school, I ruled as class president and captain of the cheerleading squad. At Webster, I had dominated the theater department, and I was a standout even in my first professional job. When I took a sabbatical during my sophomore year to tour the country performing in a vaudeville-style review, Baggy Pants. I got off that plane at LaGuardia with 10,000 songs in my heart, envisioning my life unfolding before me. I was hell-bent on first conquering Broadway, figuring Hollywood would come later. Black Broadway was at its height. The late 1970s had seen a string of successful African-American shows such as The Wiz, Ain't Misbehavin', Don't Bother Me, I Can't Cope, and Bubblin' Brown Sugar. I was a Midwestern girl who found New York City thrilling, but absolutely overwhelming. I'd been there a couple of times before, but only for a few days. I mean, I was street smart and knew how to watch my back. But still, it was a huge culture shock. Nobody spoke to each other. In my hometown, I was used to saying good morning to total strangers. The New Yorkers didn't even make eye contact. Wherever I went in the city, I felt surrounded by 20 million people. I remember standing in the shopping mall beneath the World Trade Center and feeling the sensation of an oncoming stampede, an earth tremor. I said aloud, "What the fuck is that?" The guy at the newsstand nearby heard me and calmly said, "Rush hour, lady." Mouth agape, I flattened myself against the wall as thousands of commuters surged past to board their trains on the levels below. From day one in the Big Apple, I was swept into the whirlwind life of an aspiring actress, driven by my dream. Shoulders back, titties first. Every day, rushing to auditions all over Manhattan and one or two dance classes at Frank Hatchett's famous studio at Broadway and 55th Street. I had won a voice scholarship funded by the actor Richard Kiley, the man of La Mancha himself. The scholarship provided vocal lessons with Ray Smallover, whose genius as a voice teacher was well known in the theater community. Ray taught me how to keep my vocal apparatus healthy and flexible. His lessons have sustained me to this very day. In fact, I have only lost my voice twice. The first time was in 1984 when I got pissy drunk, singing and carrying on until the wee hours at a bar in Cologne, West Germany, and had to miss the next day's matinee. The second time I lost my voice was during my first week performing on Broadway in Hairspray in 2008. I thought I would take a lovely walk through my old stomping ground, Central Park. The park was gorgeous. It was springtime and the trees and flowers were in high bloom. From Columbus Circle, I walked to the boathouse, stopping to admire every variety of tree, stone, child, street artist, and horse-drawn carriage. Just plain skippy happy. As I walked through the sheep meadow, my thoughts went back to that horrible day. Years earlier when I didn't get cast in Saturday Night Live and collapsed in sorrow on the cool meadow grass. I smiled a bit, thinking how meaningless rejection becomes as the years roll by. By the time I reached the boathouse, I realized my throat had constricted. What the flying fuck was I thinking? "Jenny, you have allergies this time of year." I hacked mucus out of my throat all the way back to Columbus Circle, because taxis were no longer able to go through the park. My vocal cords were strained, but I went to the theater anyway, knowing that my voice would come. Surely, it would come. It did not. I made my entrance on stage, opened my mouth to sing, and no sound came out. Silence. Everything went into slow motion. I pushed for the notes, praying. I lowered the register an octave. Nothing. 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 There I stood, the great Jennifer Lewis, voiceless, in front of 1,400 people in the Neil Simon Theater. To add insult to injury, as I coughed and gasped through this train wreck of a performance, a woman front row center turned slightly to her excited son, who looked to be about 10 years old and who was clearly gay. Without taking her eyes off me, the woman said to her son in a voice that was quite audible over the music, "This is not how it's supposed to be." Thank God it was the end of Act One. The curtain came down. I ran up the concrete staircase in that old theater, fell into my dressing room, and sobbed uncontrollably. To add more insult to injury, Mark Shaman, Hairspray's co-lyricist and composer, had been in the back of the house and witnessed the entire catastrophe. He walked into my dressing room and said, "Your contract says 3 months, not 3 performances. It was a brilliant line, but I was in no mood to laugh with my best friend. Asshole. When I first hit town fresh from college, I was sobered by the competition, especially in dance class. Y'all, they came from the four corners of the nation, and they were the best. The motherfuckers of the motherfuckers. They danced like Shaka fucking Zulu's children, like kings and queens. They were long, and they were graceful. The Adonises and the Aphrodites of Juilliard, Alvin Ailey and Carnegie Mellon. They strode across the dance floor like Thompson gazelles on the Serengeti. They stared at themselves in the wall mirrors like they owned the world. They walked in first position. They wore tights to show their perfectly formed muscles. They were beautiful. Gods, almost. I felt doubt. Concern. Okay, I was fucking losing it, and called my mother, sobbing from a payphone behind the Lunkfontein Theater on 46th Street. Mama. Mama, everybody wants to be a star up here in New York. Who knew all these people were gonna be here chasing the same dream as me? Oh, my God, it's all too big, Mama. And there's so many of them. And they're so good. Part of me wanted to give up and run home. But quit? Me? Fortunately, the bigger part of me knew I was on the right track. One of my first auditions was for an out-of-town production of Daddy Goodness, starring Clifton Davis. It was a musical based on a play by Richard Wright, the brilliant author of Native Son. At the audition, I met Cheryl Lee Ralph, the wonderful actress and activist who remains a good friend. At age 20, Cheryl was strikingly beautiful. And she still is today at 93. After the audition, we went off together to Howard Johnson's in Times Square to kill time before contacting our answering services for what we just knew would be a callback. I ate hot apple pie a la mode. Cheryl ate a banana split. Neither of us got the gig, but we bonded that day, vowing that we'd become stars on Broadway and in the movies. Years later, I was one of Cheryl's bridesmaids when she married her 8th husband. Okay, it was her 2nd husband. I was living temporarily with my college boyfriend, Miguel, and his mother in Brooklyn. In their 4th-floor walk-up above a karate dojo on the corner of Flatbush Avenue and St. Mark's, Miguel was perhaps to this day the one true love of my life. We'd been together during my first 2 years at Webster, but it was off and on because my love life in college had a lot of moving parts. But I always found my way back to Miguel. He was born and raised in the Dominican Republic. He was a brilliant man who held 2 master's degrees, and when we met, Miguel was at Webster working on his PhD in math, no less. I loved Miguel for his intelligence and his delicious accent, especially the way he said my name, Yennefer. He was about 10 years older than me, but a very healthy man. And ladies, I do mean very healthy. I recall how his skin tone blended with mine. Together we were a beautiful caramel macchiato. Miguel was the first vegetarian I'd ever met. I found him fascinating. Once he got his PhD, Miguel went back to live with his family in New York while I finished my last 2 years of college. We maintained a long-distance relationship, and I stayed with him a few times during my junior and senior years when I went to New York for auditions. After we'd been a couple for some time, Miguel said something that stayed with me. "Yennefer," he said, "do you have this great ability to get the attention of the people? But then you say no thing." I thought, so what? I'm an entertainer, not a teacher. Miguel's mother, Andrea, didn't speak much English, but she treated me like a daughter and sure could cook her ass off. She made plantains and concon, a traditional dish of the Dominican Republic, scraping the delicious crispy rice off the bottom of the burnt pot. If you've ever had concon, you understand why thinking about it still makes my mouth water after all these years. Miguel and I went to Manhattan a lot. He played chess in Washington Square Park. I love that he won most of his games, being a genius and all. But with my short attention span, it was tough for me to sit and watch something as boring as chess. So I would wander off and go watch the street artist in the middle of the square. I liked their raw, natural style. It was there that I first met Phyllis Yvonne Stickney, who later played my daughter, Aileen, in What's Love Got to Do with It. She was so captivating, talking politics in her red, black, and green turban. I had always been attracted to intelligent people. I find them fascinating because I just didn't pay as much attention in school as I ought to have. If it wasn't about music or movies, I didn't see what it had to do with me. Many of my outings with Miguel were punctuated with a visit to Mamoon, the falafel joint on McDougal Street that has become a Greenwich Village institution. We'd stand in line arm in arm, pressing against each other, laughing and talking as we waited our turn to squeeze into the hole in the wall for our delicious falafels drenched in tahini sauce. The few sticky tables were usually taken, so once we'd ordered and paid, we would sit on the bench out front, stuffing our faces and wiping tahini from the corners of each other's mouths. Once, Miguel noticed the cook who had served us leaning against a building smoking a cigarette. Disgusted that a smoker had touched his food, Miguel threw what remained of his falafel in the trash. I love that Miguel kept his body pure, and I made note to continue hiding my nicotine habit from him. We had a beautiful, loving relationship, but we fought a lot, mostly because Miguel wanted to marry me. I couldn't marry him or anyone else. I had already taken a husband, New York City itself. We were the perfect couple. I've always been dramatic, and New York matched my extraness. The city was extreme, and so was I. Everything about New York seemed over the top, like me. Y'all know I'm loud. The entire city seemed to vibrate at a frequency, propelling me to reach for more, more, more. This was the relationship I wanted. Though I loved Miguel deeply, his proposal didn't stand a chance. Through the decades, New York City has remained a magical, fascinating adventure for me. The people, the conversations. For instance, nearly 30 years after I arrived in New York. I was sitting in the lobby of the Public Theater, studying my ass off for a role playing opposite Meryl Streep in Mother Courage and Her Children. A young black man, who I think was a summer intern, approached me in the lobby. Without saying so much as excuse me, he sat down next to me in a huff and growled. Why do